The reading is from 2 Samuel, chapter 12, and verses 1 to 10. The Lord sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, "There were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveller came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveller who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah, and if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own."
Such an attractive woman, that reader. I do enjoy her reading. Right, the gift that nobody wants. Now, all of us have probably had at Christmas gifts that we didn't want. You know, that 43rd pair of socks from Aunt Mabel. She gave them the year before and the year before that and the year before that. Or I used to have a lot of handkerchiefs. I use tissues personally, but so anybody's short of handkerchiefs, I can pass on a few to you. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about something very specific. The reading was a bit of a clue. We'll come back to that in a few moments. But the gift that nobody wants is the gift of confrontation. And we're going from John Ortberg's book that we've been looking at. This is a series. Unfortunately, the last one of this series was on the 15th of June, so you may not have noticed it was a series because there's been this rather large gap because of other things happening. But that's the book. It's an excellent book, and not that I've read it all, but the bits I've read are very good. And this chapter on the gift that nobody wants, it's very helpful. And I hope tonight we can learn something from it. So let's think about confrontation. Confrontation is usually regarded in a negative way, and one of the different dictionary definitions is a face-to-face meeting. That's really a face-to-face meeting, isn't it? I do believe it's the two brothers that used to be in EastEnders. I've slightly stretched the photograph to... It is, is it? An Eskimo's kissing. Thank you. The new curate is really helpful. Or the clashing of forces and ideas. And that picture does convey to some extent this sort of intensity of being face-to-face. Now, if you're the sort of person who enjoys confrontation, you really need to go for prayer ministry at the end. Because I don't think anybody should enjoy it, either giving it or receiving it. What I find is that usually you either avoid giving it or you fear receiving it. You don't want to be involved. Some years ago, when I was the leader of the community church in Surbiton, we had a young couple start attending our services that we called the meetings then, attending our meetings services. And her name was Nikki, and she'd been a Christian and sort of gone away from God and had come back. And the guy was called Paul, and he'd just become a Christian. And they were really bright young things going for it. And so they were being drawn into the church. And then I discovered that they were living together, but they weren't married. Now, I realise that all sorts of views on that. But in the community church, we had a fairly straight down the line view. We didn't think that was a good idea. Didn't think it was what God wanted or a blessing to them. And so the leaders discussed this situation, and I was delegated to go and see them. So I booked an appointment for a Sunday afternoon. I remember it well. And I really, you know, looking at lunchtime that Sunday, I was looking for a reason not to go, like I've got a headache or I must go somewhere else or the car had broken down or any reason I could think of, because I didn't want to do it. But anyway, I couldn't get out of it. And so I went to see them, and we had coffee and talked about nothing for about 10 minutes, as you do, waiting for the moment. And then suddenly Paul said to me, he said, "Oh, by the way, we realised that we've been living together." He said it to me. "We've been living together. We think that's wrong. And so I'm moving out tomorrow and we're going to get married in 4 weeks' time." Well, I wish all my times of conversation had been that easy, because it basically happened for me. But that was something I wanted to avoid. And I was fearful that they might take the hump. They might say, you know, "Well, we'll go to another church," or, you know, "or we'll turn our backs on God." So there's something worrying and scary about this whole thing of confrontation. And it's usually interpreted in our culture and our society as negative. But hopefully tonight we'll see the Bible has something that's positive as well about it. So we're going to do a little look at negative confrontation, then a longer look at positive confrontation. Okay, you ready for that? So it's just a two-part talk, unless you count what I've just done as an introduction. Looking at Simon, because he thinks I should have three. First of all, negative confrontation then. And here's three types of confrontation. There's angry confrontation. That's usually words and actions. It usually means raised voices. Sometimes it means expressive language that we wouldn't normally use. It means throwing objects. I've twice had objects thrown at me. I ducked both times and they broke ornaments instead. And it wasn't joy, by the way. I've slammed doors, and you've no doubt, well, no, perhaps you haven't. I've slammed doors. It's been part of an angry confrontation. And what happens is when that happens, people usually either return the anger or else they back off in fear and withdraw from the situation. It's a lose-lose situation. That's a way of doing it. There's the self-pity confrontation, which I means when someone's feeling ignored or overlooked or put down or forgotten, that they begin to express that. And the reaction that people make is you either continue to ignore them or else you then overcompensate. And you go say, "Well, you know, you mustn't do that because he might be offended, or you shouldn't say that because she might get upset." And so you're walking around tiptoeing on eggshells. It's not a positive situation. And then there's the indirect confrontation. I know that sounds like a contradiction, but basically that's dropping hints. That's suggesting, you know, I'm feeling this or I want that. But you don't come out and say it. You just drop these hints. People drop these hints out. And, of course, people then are uncertain what response to make. So that doesn't help either. And this negative confrontation usually results in one of the following. Accusation. "You are the person who started this fight. It's your fault." Or else blaming. Laying responsibility on someone else. I've actually heard this sentence: "Your lack of interest in our relationship led me to having an affair." So it's not really my fault, it's your fault, because you see how it goes. Belittling, putting others down with personal criticism. "Your sermon was so boring, no one was listening." In fact, two people have gone to sleep already, I can see you. No. Or lecturing. Laying down rigid guidelines. You won't understand this one. I'll explain it to you. "You will move that tent 10 centimetres to the right and position it exactly where I want it." I used to be work for, I think, 11 years as a padre on the Isle of Wight in a youth camp. And it was a two and a half week camp. And we had children, some from churches, but mainly from sponsored groups. It really quite naughty children, really. Underprivileged, but really naughty with it. But there was an advance party, and two of my friends went to the advance party to help the commandant, who's long gone to be with Jesus, and we all sigh of relief when he went. This commandant was sort of said, "Help you, you put this tent here." So they put this tent up, and he came to check it, and it was 10 centimetres out, which isn't a lot, is it? And he made them take it down and put it in the right place. Now, I know what I'd have said to him. We'd have had another confrontation, wouldn't we? And it wouldn't have been polite. But so there's that sort of lecturing. Then the scolding, the finger-pointing tirade of displeasure. I'm fed up with this. I'm in charge of this event. Do as you're told. I want it done my way. Confrontation. And then there's the name-calling, the personalised put-downs. Stupid idiot, can't you see what you've done? Has something like that been said to you ever? Many children get that said to them by parents. Parents don't mean it. You know, you silly child. It's a put-down. It's damaging. It's a confrontation. And every one of these things we've mentioned here has one thing in common. They damage and can even destroy relationships. They're very dangerous. Now, you or I may feel better for having a go at somebody. We may have got something off our chest and we feel better. But what's it done for them? This is a negative situation, and we need to move to something more positive. In the chapter of his book, John Ortberg quotes this quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who's a German theologian. He says this: "Nothing can be more cruel than the leniency which abandons others to their sin. Nothing can be more compassionate than the severe reprimand which calls another Christian in one's community back from the path of sin." Or as Proverbs 27:6 says, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful." You know, some wounds are healing. And when sometimes a friend comes and says to you, "You're out of line, that wasn't very good, that wasn't very helpful, that hurt somebody else." Sometimes we need that, don't we? That's a wound from a friend. Whereas those people who don't care, we have no relationship with, they don't care about us, can say all sorts of nice things. But they don't. It's not any meaning to it. And so, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. So we're going to come to this story of David and Nathan. We're going to dwell on this for a few minutes, that Joy read about. She read chapter 12, but if we go back to chapter 11, we see where this story began. Some of you will be familiar with it, perhaps others not. It was a time in Israel's history where David had restored peace, prosperity, and military power to Israel. And the Bible says it was spring, and it was the time of the year when the armies went off to fight. It's interesting, it seems to be like they did that. It was spring, so they went off to fight. It was just what they did, you know. And David didn't go this particular time. He sent Joab to be in charge of his armies. Now, let's be clear, David should have gone. He should have gone, but he didn't. And the fact that he didn't led him into a big problem. So there's a little lesson to link with it. Sometimes we should do things, and when we don't do them, we open up other situations that perhaps we wish weren't opened later. So he stayed at home. And late one afternoon, after he's had his midday siesta, he was walking on the roof of his palace. And he sees a woman taking a bath. Now, that wasn't particularly unusual. She would take a bath at that time because the barrels of water they kept would be warmest at that point after the hot day. And most of the men were off at war. So she was fairly comfortable in doing this. She didn't know the king had got his spyglasses out looking to see who he could see. And the woman is beautiful. And the Bible tells us that David is filled with lust, which is a nice way of saying he wanted to have sex with her. That's what he was after. He saw this woman. He got a number of wives himself, but he saw another woman and he wanted her. So he sent someone to find out who she was. And they came back with the message that her name is Bathsheba. And she's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Now, Uriah was with the army. He may have been a Hittite, but he was fighting for the Jewish army. He was serving David. He was with his brothers on the battlefield. And so, knowing that Uriah was away, David sent for Bathsheba. I guess she had little choice in the matter. He was the king, so she came. And you can guess what happened next. Yes, they did. They slept together. Now, the king that God had chosen, anointed, blessed, and said, "You're a great king," had just committed adultery. You know, we can pussyfoot around, but that's what happened. They committed adultery. And the story might have ended there. No one might have ever known anything about this, but for one thing. A few weeks or a month or so later, Bathsheba sent a message, and she said, "I'm pregnant." And the Bible's quite specific in this, that prior to David having his fling with her, she'd just ended her menstrual cycle. And so she couldn't have been pregnant before that. So David was the man. He was the man who did this, and now he's got a problem. There is no way that the child could be Uriah's. So he has a plan, plan A. Plan A is to bring Uriah back from the battle, from the war, and to tell him, have a few days off. You're fighting well. Well done. Go and spend a few nights with your wife. Have a rest, then go back to the battle. You see the plan? Have a few nights with his wife. They'll sleep together, inevitably. And then it's, who knows who the baby is. So, but David's plan A fails because Uriah says, I won't do it. He actually slept at the door of his own house. He said, my brothers and my fellow soldiers are fighting, and I'm not going to enjoy my life while they're in that situation. So plan B, David says, come have a meal with me, Uriah. He plies him with wine. He gets him drunk. And then he thinks he's lost control. He will not be able to make clear decisions. Then he'll go home. But no, he doesn't. This man has got character. This man is a man of conviction. And so he still refuses to go home and sleep with his wife. So there's plan C. Plan C is to send Uriah back to the war front, and he carries a message with him. The message would have been sealed, but the message was for Joab. And the message was, Joab, make sure when the battle starts that Uriah's at the front. Make sure as the battle gets fiercer, some of his colleagues fall back from him and he's killed. And that is exactly what happened. Exactly what happened. Third time lucky for David, but not so lucky for Uriah. He's just to pause again. This man is a completely innocent character in this, isn't he? He's doing what he should do. He's at war. He's with the army. His wife is allegedly doing what she should be doing. David intervenes into that, breaks into that. And this man of innocence. You know, sometimes we make right choices. We stand for the right things. And we still find out it doesn't seem to work out that well for us. Has that been your experience? Sometimes you know you've made the right choice. But it hasn't, you know, nothing's gone smoothly. It didn't for Uriah. So now David is now an adulterer and a murderer. Anointed king, blessed of God, chosen of God, selected by God to be a great king, who's now an adulterer and a murderer. And the story goes on, and after a suitable period of mourning, the hypocrisy of this is amazing, isn't it? Suitable period of mourning, Bathsheba is brought to the palace and become one of David's wives, and in due course gives birth to a son. And there is no evidence in this story that David shows any particular remorse or feeling guilty or whatever. And it looks like because he's the king and not many people know about this, just a few servants and Joab would know and so on, but not many people know about it. The end is he's going to get away with this. He's the king. He's going to get away with it. But the very last verse of chapter 11 says this, but the Lord was displeased with David. As you and I know, we can fool most of the people some of the time or some of the people most of the time, but we can't fool God any time. He knows what's going on in our hearts, in our minds, the things we do and the things we say. And so Joy's reading began with the Lord sent Nathan the prophet to David. So Nathan would know David well. He was his personal prophet. He no doubt loved him and served him as king. But now Nathan's got the task of confronting the king with a message from an angry God. So how does he go about it? Does he sort of jump in with both feet? Or does he sort of, you know, spend a long time waffling at the edges? Like probably you or I would, one of those two extremes, aren't we? No, he has the brilliant idea, which no doubt was of the Holy Spirit, to tell a story. And he tells David this story. He tells it as if it's an actual happening, and because David, this is what's happening in your kingdom. And he tells the story that Joy read to us, two men, certain town, one rich, one poor, very rich, the other very poor. The rich man owned sheep and cattle by the bucket load, if you can have them by bucket loads. And the poor man, just one tiny lamb, a lamb he cuddles. And you want to go, do you want to go, at this point in the story? You know, it's that sort of thing. He's nursing this lamb. He's holding it. It's precious to him. Then the guest arrives, must give him a meal. He's got all these sheep and lambs and cattle, whatever. But no, he doesn't use any of his own. He takes this one from this one man and he kills this lamb, and that's what they have, roast lamb for dinner. And at this point, David is incensed. David jumps up, I imagine, and says, this man should be killed. This man should die. This man should be put to death. And here comes the confrontation moment. Nathan is now faced with an angry king who could have him killed just like that. But he says these words, "You are that man." Just four or five words. I haven't counted them, so I can't remember. "You are that man. You are that man." Yeah, four words. But they are such powerful words, aren't they? The implications of those are on and on. And the end result of Nathan's willingness to confront David is that David confesses, he repents, and his life is... We never know what would have happened if this hadn't happened. If Nathan hadn't have done this, what would have happened to David? He may have gone into a downward spiral of sin and deception. And the blessing of God, as it did with Samuel, would have lifted off of him. We don't know. But Nathan did as he was told by God. Did it in a very wise and careful way. Didn't go in this eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation of anger. Told a story. Got David to feel the injustice of that story. And then for David to realize, that's what you did. That's what you did. That's what you did with Bathsheba. That's what you did with Uriah. And when you have a moment, read Psalm 51. Because Psalm 51 is David's psalm after this experience with Nathan visiting him. Okay, so I want to suggest to you, and this is certainly what John Ortberg suggests in his book, that you and I, we need truth tellers. Nathan told David the truth. He did it carefully, craftily, cleverly, but the point came when he said, "You are that man." And John Ortberg in his book says, every one of us needs a few people to tell us the truth about our hearts and our souls. We all have weak spots and blind spots that we cannot navigate on our own. If honestly you're sitting there thinking, I don't have a blind spot, then you are truly deceived. We all do, every one of us, including the vicar. So it affects everybody. We need someone to remind us of our deepest aspirations and values and to warn us when we're going off track. We need someone to help us question our motives and examine our consciences. John Ortberg says we need a few truth tellers. When I was leading the community church, as I said earlier, there were four or five people who I went to over a period of time, and I said, one of them was Ruth Bellchamber, who so many of you would know. One of them was Ruth, but you probably wouldn't know the other people. And I went to them and I said, I give you permission to speak into my life anything you want to. If you want to speak about my personal life, my private life, my church leadership, my preaching, whatever skills, whatever gifts, whatever I do that you're involved with, and these are people who are in close relationship with me, then I want you to do that. I want to be in that place where, I didn't know this word then, but it's a great word, I wanted to be in a place where there were truth tellers for me, who would tell me the truth. And of course, they did. And sometimes it wasn't very nice. Not that they told me badly, but it was uncomfortable for me. Because although the theory is wonderful, the reality of this is I don't want to be told. You still fight that. We have a fear of truth. One of my favourite films of probably the last 20 years, I don't know how long it goes back now, is a film called A Few Good Men. Anybody seen that? Tom Cruise, Demi Moore, and Jack Nicholson. And Cruise plays a lawyer. It's all set in the Army or Navy or whatever, in the American forces. He's a lawyer. And at one stage, right towards the end of the film, he's cross-examining Jack Nicholson, who's an Army officer who's sort of covered up something. And in the climax of the film, Cruise almost pleads him and says, "All I want is the truth." And I wish I could do Nicholson's voice, but he has this wonderful sort of voice that he responds back saying, "You can't handle the truth." We sometimes feel like that, you know, we can't handle the truth. And yet Jesus took a totally different view. He said, "You will know the truth, and the truth will liberate you. It will set you free." And so we are sometimes faced with a choice. I put it like this, it's an easy choice, but think about it. Do we believe Jack Nicholson or do we believe Jesus? Are we going to go for "you can't handle the truth," or are we going to go, "the truth can liberate me, it can set me free"? So we need truth tellers. And we need truth tellers to help us accept reality. One of the dangers of people, of Christians, you know, is to live in unreality, to fly along and float above the ground and not engage in reality sometimes, get super spiritual or whatever is the term. Paul in Romans 12:3 says this: do not think you're better than you really are. Be honest in your evaluation of yourselves. We need sometimes people to help us accept the reality. No, that wasn't very good, Peter. The way you put that wasn't very helpful. The way you led that thing or said that thing or did that thing or wrote that thing, actually, you could have done a lot better. Next time, take some time to prepare it. All things that have been said to me in the past. We need truth tellers to help us live with accountability. All of us are accountable in some way to something, to someone. And when someone who could come along and say, how's it going? Do some things need to change? Like a checklist. We send our cars regularly for services. And I don't mean church services. To the garage for a service. We need sometimes to have a checklist, have a checkout of how we're doing. Now you can say, well, I can do that for myself. Yes, you can to a degree. Well, there's the Holy Spirit. Yes, he will be involved in this. But we've been put in community and relationship. We belong to one another. It doesn't work on our own. Christianity is not meant for individuals. It's meant to be together. That's the way it's meant to work. And so we need other people, these truth tellers. We need truth tellers to help us keep our commitments. You know, we make statements about praying and Bible reading and giving and other things, serving. It's good sometimes if someone comes along and says, well, how's it going? How is your prayer life? How is your giving? I mean, we mustn't talk about those sort of things. It's private. Is it? You may think it is. I really don't. And then we need truth tellers to support us in the battles, the conflicts we face, those sins we battle with, those habits that we can't seem to shake off, those addictions or whatever it is. How great when we've got someone who comes alongside and says, how's it going? Not judging us, not giving us the third degree if we're not succeeding, but out of love and out of compassion, coming alongside to help us. So as I draw to a close, this may seem to you to be far-fetched or even unnecessary. I'm not here to engage in an argument with you, but I want to tell you, it worked for King David, didn't it? I know it's an argument from we don't know what would have happened, but what would have happened, I still ask the question, if Nathan had not done what he did. You know, where would David have gone? How would his life ended up? And it worked for me when I was in a position of incredible responsibility and had 400 people in a church that I was supposed to be the spiritual head, the vicar equivalent. You know, and I needed that input into my life. And so, but I wanted to build in some safeguards. And these are the three. I'm going to finish with this. Have more than one truth teller. Sometimes people say, I'll let my best friend be the truth. I'll let my partner. Sometimes your best friend and your partner love you too much to tell you the truth or can't share your blindness sometimes. Most times when I ask Joy if I preached, how was it? She says, that was good. I'm really waiting for the day when she says, that was awful. And she lists the whole thing. She said, tonight's her night. But you can hear what I'm saying. If we're going to have truth tellers, let's have more than just have more than one. And you choose them. We're not talking about this sort of shepherding concept, or this is horrific, or you know, somebody as a result of tonight can't. You know, I can't go up to Sally and say, you know, I'm going to tell you all about your life. No, it would be Sally or me or anybody else to invite people, trusted people, people who knew her or him or them or me, and say, Would you play this role? Because if you're asking someone to do it, you're asking to do something quite responsible and a serious role. And then to meet with them on a regular basis, or else it doesn't work. You know, my car can go for a year without a service because it's designed to, but I'm not designed to go that long. I need people to speak into my life on a more regular basis. When I prepared this and ran through it, I had no way knowing how I was going to finish. Because this is not one of these spiritual ones where, you know, let's all be filled with the Spirit now and stand up. Or this is very down to earth and practical. So I'm just finished. That's it. Do you want truth tellers in your life? It's up to you.